The IMG Roadmap is the only podcast dedicated to coaching international medical graduates and success blueprints for this unique pathway. I am Dr. Nina Loom, your host, a previous IMG turned hospital medicine physician, healthcare administrator, speaker, and coach. I empower, encourage, and equip you with actionable steps that you can take towards the residency position of your dreams. Hey guys, welcome to yet another episode of the IMG Roadmap podcast. I'm so excited that we're still alive. It's about a year and 6 months since the podcast was started, and the stats have just been going up. A lot of you are listening and getting inspired and encouraged and empowered. And that's exactly why I continue to record these episodes, because I know that it adds so much value to your life. So today's guest is Dr. Cynthia Tan. She's the non-US IMG and incoming anesthesiology resident. She's passionate about cooking, mental health, and mentorship. She believes that though the IMG journey's tough, so are you. She went to Warwick Medical School in University of Warwick in England, but she's actually Aussie. So this is pretty awesome because it just tells you how far so many of us have come in order to achieve our independent goals of practicing or training in medicine here in the US. And no dream is too small, guys. Like, it doesn't matter where you come from. Your dream is valid and it's not too small or should not be disregarded because it's yours. So I'm so happy to welcome Dr. Tan. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm doing good. I love how enthusiastic you are.
I try to keep the energy up with some, I don't really drink caffeine, but I think just positivity, you know, just a little bit of positivity.
That's so important.
Yeah. So I know I kind of gave a little rundown, but can you, in your own words, kind of tell us a little bit about your IMG background?
Sure. So yeah, I'm Aussie. I am from Australia, from Western Australia, a town called Perth. I did my undergraduate degree there and a bachelor's of biomedical sciences, and then decided that I wanted to pursue medicine. So I went to medical school. Actually, my first 2 years was in Malaysia. I did a transfer program where I did preclinicals in Malaysia, and then I went to the UK for my clinical years, my last 3 years. Worked as an intern for a year in England, and then made the move over to the US. So it was when I did my clinical years in England and the UK, I decided that I was going to pursue the US pathway of residency.
Wow. So from Perth, Australia to Malaysia to England, mm-hmm. and then now to New Jersey. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Wow.
So I've made a long way here.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. Very, very impressive. So you just recently matched into what specialty was that? Anesthesiology, I believe. And that is one of the specialties that I know IMGs that are interested in usually shy away from, because they have this perception that it is too competitive for an international medical graduate. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so I definitely can relate to that. When I first decided that I wanted to do anesthesia, I wasn't sure if that's something I should pursue, especially with, you know, how competitive it is. And my STEP score wasn't as high as I had hoped for it to be. So I was like, hey, should I still try and pursue anesthesia or should I look at doing other specialties? But thankfully, I had a mentor who told me, you know, don't let your STEP score be the reason you decide not to do it. So I was like, okay, I will try. And here I am, matching to anesthesia starting in 3 weeks.
So let's talk about some things that you mentioned. You mentioned a low STEP score. Can you give us insight? Mm-hmm. Because right now, you know, you're on the other side having matched, and looking back, I know the top reason so many IMGs should shy away of this whole entire process is because they feel insecure about the step one score. And so that being said, can you, you know, share a little bit about why you felt your score wasn't good enough and how did you overcome it?
So I think for me, I was always told as an IMG, you should be getting 240s to 260s. If you don't get a 240 to 260, don't even think about applying. I had doctors who I was working with in the UK who knew people who had come to the US, and they said the same thing to me. So I guess that was kind of discouraging when they were like, oh yeah, if you don't get anything between a 240 and 260, don't think about applying. And when I got my STEP score back, it was lower than 240. And I was like, okay, well, does that mean I should give up my whole idea and dream of applying, or should I just continue trying? So I think it's very easy to feel insecure, and it's very easy to kind of be like, okay, I didn't get, you know, what people think IMG should get, so forget it, like throw that dream out the window. But when you really look through the, you know, the steps of match and like through charting the outcome, when I actually really broke it down, you had people who were matching like with a pass who were non-US IMGs. So I was like, okay, well, if they managed to match, there must be a way around it. And I just tried to figure out what the ways were. And for me, it was, you know, doing much better in my 2CK, getting a US clinical elective, networking in the US. And I think those were things that really helped me as well.
Yes, absolutely. Because you mentioned in the first part, you mentioned having a mentor. And now you've mentioned networking, and obviously improving from step one to step two is a huge thing. And I tell IMGs this all the time. You can really score very low. To all of you listening, you could have a really poor performance in step one, but then step two, you do so much better that you actually have a story around it. And that just allows for when, for example, during your interview, if it comes up, you can definitely speak to how you learned a little bit differently about test taking, or how you approach test taking differently, or the lessons learned from that jump in your score. And then that shifts the conversation from, oh, woe is me, I have a low score, to, hey, look what I did to get better. And people like to hear that. They like to hear, look what I did to get better, as opposed to, hey, woe is me, I have a low step score. So I really appreciate you shedding some light on that. So you did mention, you know, networking and doing US clinical rotations. But prior to that, you said, you know, you had a mentor as well. How did you find a mentor as an international student?
So I got my mentor from my U.S. clinical rotation. So I did a month of electives at Cornell in New York City. And from my time there, you know, I was pretty proactive with trying to meet attendings. So I scheduled as many appointments as I could with different attendings, the program directors, the assistant program director. And I was just trying to get a gut idea of, like, you know, how hard it is to match with an IMG into anesthesia, just the whole general idea of matching as an IMG and matching into anesthesia as a field. And eventually, after speaking to a good handful of people, one of them I asked if she would, you know, write me my letter, and we stayed in contact, and she became one of my mentors. And the other one, we just stayed in contact by email. And then when application season came around, he was like, all right, let's set up meetings. And he was very much in touch with my whole process. He was, when I first moved to the US, he met up with me to kind of talk about how I should approach my year off, because I had some gaps in my application, how I should approach my year off, what I should do so that it looks good when it comes to the time for me to apply. So it was just really about trying to get like meetings with different people, and then finding the people that I connected with and keeping in touch with them, and eventually becoming their mentee.
You know, that's actually a good point, because one of the, you know, I get this question on Instagram all the time. You know, how do I find a mentor? How do I find a mentor? Mm-hmm. And it's such an easy, it's a difficult question with a very easy answer, in the sense that being a people person is really what you need to find a mentor. What does that mean, guys? I know some people listening and saying, well, what is she saying? What I mean is you have to be approachable, and you have to approach people. And you have to position yourself in the circles where you're likely to meet these physicians. And such areas or places is doing that rotation. It's doing that elective, whether it's paid or unpaid. It's just doing it and being in the presence of the people that you want to be. And then second, when you're in their presence, it's taking the next step to say, I'm going to establish relationship. And none of us will just walk off the street and say, hey, would you be my friend to anyone, right? We'll typically just engage in conversation, find mutual interest, and just hone in on that. And a lot of times, there's no right or wrong way to find a mentor. But the most common way is just in your day-to-day meetings with physicians who are doing exactly what you want to be. And I think that that's sort of what you display in your story, too, is here you were at Cornell in New York, working, but then you didn't just let it be, I'm just here for rotation. You had objectives. You had objectives of, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to meet other humans and talk to other humans. And hopefully I can get a letter of recommendation. I can get to meet another human in the specialty that I'm interested in that I can learn from and ask for their help. And I think it's just like, there's no, you know, there's no manuscript, there's no Bible for this. It's just a matter of being a people person and being approachable. I mean, how would you say that went down for you? Like approaching this person and establishing that mentor-mentee relationship?
So it was definitely difficult because at the time I was very nervous. I was like, oh, should I ask them? Should I wait at the end of the rotation? Should I ask them at the beginning? Like, when should I ask them? Is it too much if I ask them early? So I kind of was a bit anxious about the whole thing. But then I was like, okay, well, if I don't ask them now, then it's going to be too late. And then if I ask them at the end, they're not going to know, like, they're going to be like, oh, wait, like, you didn't tell me early on. So I was like, okay, well, if I knew what I wanted and if I knew that this is someone I was going to work with for the whole week, then just bring it up. And I brought it up. I was like, oh, you know, I am going to be applying in a year or two, and I really love it if you would be willing to write me a letter, especially as we're working together for the next week or so. And they were very happy to do so.
No, I agree, because I've never met a physician that's not happy to help another student to achieve their own goal. Reason being, every physician in practice right now had the same experiences that you, the listener, had at one point or the other, or have at one point or the other as a student. So we have a great sense. Physicians are generally empathetic people. I mean, evidence the kind of work that we do, right? Evidence by the kind of work we do. So if you think about people who literally want to help others alleviate their suffering and pain in one way or the other, or they really sacrifice a whole lot of time to get one particular thing, I don't know why some students find it so hard to open their mouth and communicate with physicians who are more likely to understand them than anyone else. I think it's that fear factor that you mentioned, and that anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. That just seems to, it clouds the judgment. It clouds rational thinking. We go into full-blown fire and flight mode, and we just forget to just think through things rationally. And it's holding us back. And that's one of the key areas I notice when I work with IMGs within the IMG roadmap. In my private coaching program, I notice it's a lot of lack of confidence and so much fear and anxiety, which is truly, if you look into it, unfounded.
Yeah, that's, I completely agree with that. I think we see, as IMGs, think that we're lesser, and as a result, we get this fear and anxiety.
Yeah, I agree. We definitely carry a lot of that imposter syndrome because, you know, you have well-qualified physicians and, you know, brilliant students who really have what it takes to train and practice here. But for some odd reason, Student Doctor Network and Reddit threads have disqualified them, and they believe that. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. You know, and then there's micro people like myself and you that are saying, no, 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 it's not entirely true. Yes, one person or some of the people had bad experiences, but you have to look at the detail. Like, you can't just, you know, hone in on one particular story and that gets to define everybody else. You get to create your own medical success story. Like, nobody else can do that for you. And that's just something that, you know, it's, as I continue, I love working with IMGs, and I continue to just help people shift their mindset into something else. Yeah. So let's talk about some of your challenges that you had to overcome, because most people are going to listen and they'll say, well, she's from Australia. She trained in England. Like, she has this other benefits that I don't have. Yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. Excuses, right? They're going to make excuses. Like, everybody else has a perfect life except them, right? So let's speak to that person who is beginning to already think that, and share to them, hey, it's not always, we all have different types of challenges and different types of struggles that we have to overcome. Do you want to share some of them? You wrote out some in your intake form as to certain things that you had to overcome. Do you want to talk to us about some of that?
Yeah, sure. So the biggest one was my step one score. That was definitely a hindrance for me. And I was like I said, I was unsure if I should have it even applied to anesthesia. So I did step one in the UK in my MS3 equivalent year, where I was doing, you know, like 10-hour days at the hospital. And I was coming back home, studying for my UK exams, and then trying to squeeze in like 1 or 2 hours to study for STEP. And I did this over 8 months, which is a very long time to study for STEP. And eventually, you know, I burned out because I was trying to do a billion things at once to get my STEP exam done. So that was one of them. Another big thing for me was I had a gap in my application. So I was meant to apply 2019 for the 2020 match. So a whole year and a bit before what I ended up doing. But so it was in the middle of COVID. I was trying to get my US visa to come over here. And as a result of, you know, COVID and delays and things being shut down, I was getting a green card and I couldn't get my green card on time. And that just pushed my whole application off because I was told by my mentor, if I am eventually getting a green card, I should just wait to apply with my green card and not risk the whole getting a J1 and having to go back home and then coming back or doing a waiver. So I ended up having a year and a half, nearly 2 year gap between finishing the UK and starting residency in the US. And my other big challenge was during that gap and moving to the US, I fell into depression. I guess just, you know, going from being someone who was working full-time as a doctor, having a daily purpose, coming to the US just before COVID happened and then everything was shut down. You know, I was completely isolated. I didn't have any family. I didn't have any friends. I couldn't work. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't go home. So I was just kind of stuck in my apartment and I had like nowhere to go. I fell into pretty severe depression and I ended up needing to go on antidepressants and weekly therapy. So those three things are, I guess, my big challenges through my application process.
Yeah. Thank you so much for opening up about even what some would consider very personal issues, because you know, dealing with depression is something that a lot of us shy from even talking about. And mm-hmm. I know it takes a certain degree of vulnerability to be open about that and to say, hey, I had to seek help and I took the help and, you know, took the medications and had to take care of myself. And for anyone listening, that's if you're dealing with signs of depression, and a lot of us know what those are because we learned that in school, if you are feeling like that, please do reach out, do seek help, do embrace pharmacotherapy if that's what's needed. Don't ever feel like you are alone. And so I just want you all to remember that. And you're listening from Dr. Tan, who has been where you're at. And she's saying, you know, I did all of these things in spite of this diagnosis, in spite of the other huddles with the visa and having to switch status and then the pandemic interrupting a lot of that as well. In spite of all of that, here she is coming back to tell you guys it's possible. So I hope that you run with that and you are inspired by her story and you can learn a lesson or two from her pathway. So let's just pivot a little bit into some other areas as to your application in depth. So how many programs did you end up applying into, and did you apply then as a non-US IMG, like a visa applicant, or did you apply as a permanent resident?
So I applied as a permanent resident, but I was still considered a non-US IMG on my application. I'm not sure why, but that's what it said on my application. And I ended up applying only to 14 anesthesia programs. And I also did apply to some prelim programs and a handful of IM programs, because I was obviously quite worried that I wasn't going to get into anesthesia. So I decided to dual apply.
Yeah. So let's talk about the preliminary programs, because I think this is an area that I think IMGs don't leverage enough of. So for those that are applying into advanced specialties, such as anesthesia, derm, radiology, some surgical programs, you have the opportunity of applying into a preliminary program. And I'm going to let Dr. Tan tell us a little bit about why she chose that and what that is. Can you share your perspective on that and why you did it?
Sure. So for me, for anesthesia, there's obviously the option of doing an advanced program where you match it with a prelim, so it's 1 year prelim, 3 years advanced, or getting into a categorical where you get the full 4 years. I was very lucky that I got the categorical position, but in the chance that I didn't, I wanted to have a prelim position as an option for me. So with the prelim year, what essentially it does is that you have 1 year of clinical experience in the US, whether it's in medicine or surgery. And if you had matched into an advanced position as well, then you get to go into your advanced position after you complete your prelim year. But if you don't match into an advanced position, it's great because, I mean, it's not great that you didn't match, but it's great to have the prelim year because that essentially gave you a whole year of US clinical experience where you're working as a resident and you're being paid to do the work. You get exposure, network, people who will write you letters as a resident. And also, you may or may not get opportunities to work in the field that you want to apply into. And, you know, they may have met you and you're like, okay, yeah, this person worked as a prelim and they were a great resident. So I would consider them for my advanced position or the next year's position. So I think a prelim year is really important to know about and to apply into, especially for IMG, because it gives you that 1 year experience if in the worst case you don't match into a full position. And also for me, my plan was if I hadn't matched into anesthesia, I would have hopefully matched into a prelim position and then worked in anesthesia related fields during electives and then hopefully reapply and match into anesthesia.
Yeah. And, you know, I like that you did that. And I usually recommend, especially for those IMGs that come to me for advice, to consider preliminary spots or transitional year spots, because it could be an opportunity for you to get a letter of recommendation for the next cycle of application, mm-hmm. right? It can also be an opportunity for you to network, because if you're at, say, you're doing a preliminary program at a certain university program and you get to begin to learn about the particular specialty that you're actually interested in that's located within that facility, your preceptors may actually overlap in some instances if you rotate on that service or you rotate on another, because usually your first year residency is 12 months of just different rotations. So you may be doing a prelim year, but you get to do 1 month in the OR. So guess what? You get to meet an anesthesiologist, right? Or you could do mm-hmm. a 1 month internal medicine and you get to meet an internist and maybe your goal was to match into internal medicine. So you can definitely use the preliminary as a leverage point, as a backup plan, if you don't have any spots in the categorical side, which is the 3 year or 4 year track. So I really recommend just look into that, go on the internet. There's tons of just blogs about preliminary years and what that means for those of you who are going to be like, what's a preliminary year? Well, you could just look that up on Google and you find the answer. It'll be right there. So I am glad that you did that. And why did you choose only 14 programs? And also tell us, how many interviews did you get out of those?
So I only had 2 anesthesia interviews out of the 14. And then I had 3 prelims and 2 other internal medicine. I had 7 in total. But I only applied to 14 anesthesia programs because I had to stay in the New York, New Jersey area. So my husband's in New Jersey, so I didn't really have a choice in terms of like where I could go and where I could move to. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So a lot of people are going to be listening and say, oh my gosh, she only applied to 14 places and she got 7 interviews. So you basically converted half of the people you applied into. So people want to know. They want to know scores. They want to know how many letters. How did you distribute your letters? Did you get 3 anesthesia letters? Did you get 2 general practice letters? They're going to want to know a lot more so that they can mirror or learn from you. Do you mind going into such detail as well as to what your ERAS packet looked like?
Sure. I had 1 anesthesia letter from my US clinical experience. I decided not to use the other one because I felt that the doctor that I was with, I wasn't as close with her, and I felt like we didn't really get to connect as well as I did with the one I used. And then my remaining 3 letters were from England from the time I worked as an intern. So there were 2 internal medicine letters and 1 general surgery letter. So yeah, it was quite varied and I only had 1 US letter at the end. But I think having those letters, you know, even though they came from England, it was helpful because they were from people who knew me as a physician, as an intern, and they could speak to the character of me working. as an intern. And I think that was very helpful because it did come up in my interviews where they're like, oh, okay, like in your letter, like this was said about you, or I read that you did this thing. So that was nice that, you know, it was kind of acknowledged. And also my mentor, so my other mentor at Cornell didn't write me a letter because we didn't get to work together clinically. We met through all the lectures I attended when I was there during my elective. And he was someone that was very helpful because he was willing to make phone calls and vouch for me when I had interviews.
Yeah, I like that you shared that because that's another area that I think some I just get hung up on is there's this negative notion out there. You must have US-based preceptors write all three of your letters, when indeed the content of your letter is more important than the context. And what I mean by that is it's better off to get a medical school professor of yours that's a physician that can speak to who you are, or someone you've worked with if you already practiced in your home country, guys. Let that person write your letter because they probably know better than someone that you spend 2 weeks with in the States. Now, it is good to get at least one US-based letter in the specialty. That's always recommended because we know that that's frequently cited in the program director survey as one of the top 10 reasons who they pick for interview. So yes, do get one letter from your US preceptors. But if you can't get all three, get them from those who know you really well and can write really strong letters defending your application, because that's really all that matters. The content of your letter is better than the context. So I hope that helps somebody today. If nothing else, I hope that one point helps somebody today. So we're rounding up on your interview and we want to know, what mantra do you have for your success? And what is the one thing that kept you grounded even on those days where maybe, you know, you're having to walk into a clinic to talk to a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist about your condition and having to be dealing with all of that and then still pushing through. So what are some things that you had to tell yourself throughout this period in order to overcome it?
So one big thing that I guess I had to keep reminding myself was that I was not my step score, because it was very easy for me to be like, okay, yeah, this is my step score. I'm not going to get anything. So that was something I had to constantly remind myself. And the other thing would be that everything does happen for a reason. I know it sounds cliche, but, you know, everything happened to me for a reason. Even my year and a half of difficulties and falling into depression, like, you know, I learned so much from that time. And coming out of it, you know, I learned how much stronger that I am. And yeah, like just kind of reminding myself that, yeah, it's tough right now, but it's going to get better. And it's happening for a reason. I think those were two things I had to remind myself throughout the whole process.
Yeah, I like that. Everything does happen for a reason. I am a firm believer in that. And obviously that for me stems more towards my Christian faith and aligning it with that there is a dedicated path for every single one of us. And there is a lesson in every valley. Like every time you find yourself in a pit or you find yourself in a negative space, if for 1 second you could stop and just think and ask yourself, is there a lesson here? Is there a reason here? What is it that is bigger than me that I can't see right now? And then it just allows you to walk through that dark season with some hope. And for one reason or the other, for those who have hope, there always seems to be a light at the end of the tunnel. Yeah. It's almost as if you have to be looking for it to find it, that light. And sometimes you don't see it because you're not looking for it, because it's just a rumination of this negative space and you're never coming out of it. And no matter how much life tries to push you down, it's important that you tell yourself what's important. Otherwise, your brain's going to go wild, whatever it's being fed, whatever it's seeing, whatever it knows. But you have to sort of educate yourself in how you're going to process your difficulties, how you're going to process your pain, how you're going to process your trials, your tribulations. Because if you don't educate yourself, nobody's going to do that for you. And so I really like that you shed some light on that. And thanks so much for coming on today and sharing your story with us. How can we find you on social media, or on these internets if IMG wants to connect with you? Because, you know, a lot of people come on the show and I have tons of IMGs that want to connect with you. But again, that imposter syndrome is holding them back from reaching out. So how do you, I'd like to ask you to tell us how to find you and if it's okay to reach out so that people feel comfortable about reaching out. So where can we find you?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me on Instagram at Dr. CT Tummy Fillers, or if you want to email me, it's drctummyfillers@gmail.com. But yeah, don't be afraid. Seriously, just reach out. I am very happy to answer any questions. My inbox is always open and I always do check it. So please just reach out and ask whatever you want to ask.
Yes, guys, I'll put her Instagram handle in the show notes. So when you listen, you can just scroll down wherever you listen, Spotify, Apple, or on my blog website. You could just scroll down and click it and it'll take you directly to your profile. And while you're scrolling down, do leave us a review. We prefer a 5-star review or nothing. So do leave us a 5-star review and send in your requests, guys. You want to hear more of what specialty? Do send me an email and we can invite some other doctors on the show. And thank you so much, Dr. Cynthia Tan, for coming on. I appreciate your time. I do know that you do exceedingly well because everything that you've been through was building you up for this that's coming up. So I'm very confident that overcoming that first hurdle just makes it to where every other thing that comes in, you just like stomp it down and just walk right through it. I believe that.
Thank you. It's so great to be on here with you.